There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Mandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, grassroots action on the ground, in the garden, and on the media. I'll have part two of my conversation with author and thinker Douglas Rushkoff, author of the new book, Life Incorporated, How the World Became a Corporation and How We Can Take It Back. Do stay tuned. Well, in last week's program, Douglas and I talked about some of the elements of his new book, Life Incorporated, and specifically about the origin of the corporation, of the modern corporation, and the origin of this sort of modern corporatist mindset of a centralized currency, a very controlled economy, and one which is really designed for the benefit of corporations, often at the expense of individuals, of communities, of looser organizations of people, and how that corporate mindset now dominates our everyday life. And talked about how that really gets located at the Renaissance, and that in the period leading up to the Renaissance, what used to be called the Dark Ages, more often called the Middle Ages, and things really weren't so dark. And that, in fact, there was a time of real flourishing art and trade and commerce that was more independent, and really a point at which independent business people, so to speak, started to flourish. The middle class started to really gain power, and that corporatism, the specific authorization of the state to do business, was something which was invented by the royalty, by the lords and the kings and the queens, who were losing power in the face of the rising middle class of merchants and other business people. And that tradition we have still stands today. And that exploding the idea that corporatism was inevitable, that this is the system that was meant to be, and instead looking at how it came to be constructed and continues to be reinforced, and how it gets in the way of our everyday lives. If you missed that program, definitely go back to the radio show at radio.mediageek.net and give it a listen. And in part two of our conversation, we get into talking a little bit more than at the alternative, at grassroots action, at the action of everyday life. And so at this point, Doug starts to talk about why everyday action and taking sort of matters into your own hand is so powerful.
Right. I mean, it gets us out of that ends justifies the means trap. You know, when you have an abstract end, you end up doing things you may not like in order to get to this thing that you think you want. And that's can disconnect people from whatever their core values are as they, you know, keep their eyes on the prize. You know, and that may have worked for the civil rights movement. It worked in the 20th century for some very specific causes that were being fought in certain ways. I don't think it works as a 21st century strategy for reacquainting people with reality, with the world itself, with their kids, their communities, what they're putting in their bodies. Really, we need to relocalize a tremendous amount of human activity. Not everything. I know there's people already saying, oh, where would we get our computers if we did everything locally? Not everything, but there's many things that we can get, you know, from long distances and big corporations and central authorities and all that, that we couldn't get otherwise. But our food, our shoes, our schools, our you know, our healthcare, there's a lot of things that you can get. And I mean our healthcare, not our cancer care, you know, not our chemo. I mean our actual How do you stay healthy and not get cancer, rather than how do you treat it once it's there? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that we can provide for one another in small ways. And if we just start doing that, if we start spending our time and energy, you know, making the world that we live in, that we actually live in, a place that we want to be, rather than earning money to insulate ourselves from the world that we happen to be in, you know, I think we'll end up more efficiently reaching our goals. It's not easy. You know, people think I'm saying, oh, this is just, oh, you're saying, I mean, God, Newsweek really slammed me in the book saying, you know, after this whole big critique of corporatism and all that, he says, oh, people should just do the tired old ideas like joining a community-supported agriculture group or starting a local currency or starting a babysitting club. Like, these are things to be looked down upon because they're small. And that's what they said. They said, we don't need small ideas from Rushkoff. We need big ideas from someone really smart. And no, the fact is we've got more than enough big ideas. We saw that in the 20th century. We had communism and capitalism and fascism and socialism. We had all those great isms. That's not what we need now. What we need now are people working together to make their small worlds better and then in the aggregate, making the big world better as a result.
You know, I was about to make the observation that what you're advocating here is less ideology and some massive anti-corporatist or anti-corporation movement,
right,
so much as saying, look, there's a lot right around you that you could probably have a lot more agency in, and together with your neighbors have more control in, why not try and take a shot at that first?
Absolutely. Because, you know, ideologies at this point are almost indistinguishable from brands. You know, ideologies.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, they're big abstract things that you can believe in. And it's very, very hard to operate on an ideological level. I mean, it's fun to sit around in a seminar room in a college and talk about the various ideologies, but in the long run, I feel like ideologies are these, you know, abstract sort of branded images that give people a point of focus that's sort of up and outside themselves and beyond their experience. We all marched for the day, for the thing and the song with the man, you know, to believe, and we go, you know, and then we find out, oh, the man was having sex with his niece.
Exactly. Oh, exactly.
And then it's all over. You know, those are great top-down strategies for creating a big union or a big movement to fight against that other big dragon that we hate. Whereas that's what the dragon wants, is he loves to fight dragons because those bad dragons always win. What the dragon can't deal with is real people connected to the earth, connected to one another, who don't recognize that McDonald's is cheaper, who actually do look at the big picture and see that that's actually more expensive, and who just opt out of the fake branded abstract virtual realm altogether.
And sometimes the motivation to opt out comes less from the big ideological discussion or the debate or the propaganda than it does from just knowing and observing someone else who manages to pull it off, not as a point of demonstrating their purity, but as just a simple matter of life.
Right.
It's that exemplar that sometimes I think works better.
Right. And the fact is, you don't even need them as an exemplar, because if one person is getting it right, it requires that there be other people who are getting it right.
Yeah.
You know, if I decide, okay, my school in my neighborhood sucks, so I don't want to send my kid to private school, so I'm going to make my public school better. How am I going to make my public school better? By donating, you know, the $20,000 of time it would have taken to earn private school money, I'm going to donate that time to making my public school better. And then I'm going to quickly find out it's going to take more than just me to make that school better. It's going to take a bunch of people. So I got to get my neighbor involved. And how do I get my neighbor involved and his neighbor and so on and so on? You know, these are not things that end up happening in isolation. It's not that you move to some field in the middle of Vermont and set up your solar panels and live an organic, solitary lifestyle. You know, that will not scale unless mm-hmm. we lost 3/4 of the planet's population.
So I want to talk briefly, if we can, about media, because certainly it's something that you've been involved with for most of your career and something you're still involved with. Where does media and, you know, mass communication fit in with this approach, this bottom-up approach?
Well, it's tricky. I mean, we've got to remember that the bias of mass media is towards selling things. You know, we don't have mass media because Jack Benny wanted to reach the world with his comedy. You know, we have mass media because the newly minted brands of mass production needed a way to communicate their values to people across a 4,000-mile wide country. You know, they needed a way to convince people that, you know, the Quaker on the box of oats was as trustworthy as Joe, the guy at the oat mill who used to sell you your oats. So the bias of mass media is towards sort of mass communication down to people, you know, to get them to internalize certain values or to relate to imagery over other people. So on the one hand, mass media is itself kind of not an enemy, but antagonistic to people's connection to one another. You know, mass media is the thing you hole up in your house and everyone turns inward at their big screen TV rather than outward at their neighbors and their neighborhoods and their parks. You know, it's a way of replacing the sort of natural rhythms of nature with the artificial rhythms of television networks. You know, you don't realize it's night because you're looking at a bright TV screen, you know, and you know, people in their bodies don't realize day from night or the cycles of the moon or the cycles of the sun and the seasons. They get really screwed up. I mean, that's the way your endocrine system works. That's the way, you know, your adrenals work. Without that, you are really lost. And when you get that lost, then where else are you going to turn but commercial TV for answers to, you know, to your isolation and despair? On the other hand, we do have new media. We have interactive media. We have communications tools at our disposal that we never had before. I mean, I would think that the best role that media could play is to help people share and communicate models and mechanisms that they're using to, you know, to rebuild their world. I mean, if you want to start, you know, an organic farm, you're, you know, one Google search away from great strategies tried by great people who can tell you how to do it, you know, and how to do any aspect of it. You can find other people who are involved in it and finding what you know, battles are they fighting? What zoning laws are they coming up against and how are they getting them changed? But you look at any of us, I mean, and we can't help it. Any of us in media, you know, I've got my books and you got your radio show. I mean, we all have a part of us that wants to be on the national stage, that wants to be big, that wants to reach, I mean, not Oprah size, but, you know, John Hockenberry size or, you know, like, or Terry Gross size or something, you know, to scale up as if on a certain level, you know, we undervalue the depth of connection that we can make with people in the real world, in our real lives, and overvalue the virtual connection that we can make as, you know, human brands across the mass media. And partly that's because that's the way you get paid. You know, if I write a book that sells across the country to all different people, gets me on TV, whatever, I make more money and I can feed my family better. You know, I'm in that system. And that's where almost all of us are still tied to corporate metrics to gauge our success and our prosperity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very hard to get a job that's not working for, in one way or another, you know, for the man, And the man's not even there, of course. You know, the man is an abstract, non-living entity called a corporation. You know, the way that Lansing, Michigan now is looking at their economic problem is by saying, what corporation can we get to set up a plant here to hire us all? You know, and it's really hard for them to see that if they've got a whole bunch of people with needs and a whole bunch of people with skills and a whole bunch of land, then they have pretty much everything you need to build an economy. That an economy doesn't start with a bank loan. An economy starts with people creating value for one another. And it's just so hard for people to wrap their heads around that. And the more we look to these giant corporations to come in and save us, or giant banks to come in and bail us out after we've bailed them out, the longer we're going to be on this very unsatisfying and unhealthy treadmill.
And you're listening to an interview with Douglas Rushkoff, author of the new book, Life Incorporated, How the World Became a Corporation and How We Can Take It Back. And this is Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I am your host. Eric Yarnell returns at the controls this week. I'm glad to have Eric back here. And you can check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. It's home to the Media Geek blog. The radio show is at Radio.MediaGeek.net. And you get comments to the program live or asynchronously. Send them to me. You can do it via Twitter. The Twitter feed's at Twitter.com/MediaGeek, where you can get updates about the program, about various things going on in telecom policy and other things of general media interest. Twitter.com/MediaGeek. Or you can send me some email, paul@mediageek.net. And now we return to my interview with Douglas Rushkoff. And this year you started a radio program yourself.
I did, you know, and I don't know exactly how long I can keep it up. You know, it's hard to do free radio. I mean, I don't know if you're completely free as well, but you know, when you do a show for WFMU, you're not only free from salary and commercial radio, but you're even free from the kind of NPR like underwriting. You know, I can't get, you know, Harvest Foods to underwrite a show because I'm saying nice things about organic, you know, farmers. It's really cut the line completely, which is why, you know, free radio of that kind, it's usually easier to get, you know, someone out of college or a DJ to come and mix records for a couple of hours, you know, than it is to get someone to come and find guests and do all that it takes, you know, to put a radio show together every week. I may be in a situation where I can't actually afford to do it, which would be kind of sad, but
what motivated you to do it and to do it at WFMU?
Well, what made me want to do it at all was to have follow through on this book I'd written. You know, I realize a lot of people don't read books anymore, and that a book may not be the best unit. I mean, anyone can have my book for free. Anyone who emails me, I just send them a PDF. It's not that they're too expensive. It's that you know, the sustained 300-page argument and explanation and historical perspective is just not the way most people today get into an issue. And hearing about things, hearing, you know, stories, I wanted to have a sort of weekly examples. Here's someone doing it. Here's someone else doing it. Here's a community that's figured this out. Here's a guy who understands this. That if people every week saw real people, real regular people who are making a real difference in their own and other people's lives through, you know, implementing specific strategies, whether they're, you know, economic or social or business or environmental or mechanical, it would kind of be like almost a make magazine of taking back our world. You know, so really just sharing resources and strategies and helping inspire people, because radio, you know, is a very hot medium, as McLuhan would say. It's a very emotional, inspirational medium. And I thought, here's a way to really help inspire people to connect with one another. And also it's a show that invites people to make segments and upload them. So, you know, we're getting more of those now, but the idea is a show called Media Squat, and this is like a squat in the media space for people to just produce the stuff that they want to get out there. And because radio is an old medium, it just seemed like a fun way to touch people. And FMU, because FMU was letting me do it, you know. You know, NPR is a whole, you know, not that I wouldn't try, but I don't know that these are even the kinds of ideas that work on NPR. NPR is still corporate funded. It's the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It's, you know, Monsanto and Del Monte are paying for those shows to happen. So there's a certain point at which they can't really undermine the system that's keeping them alive.
Yeah, I share your struggle. This is a free show in all those ways which you put forward, and I have a home for it at WNUR, which is the university-owned station for Northwestern University, but has a very good signal into Chicago. But all of the time that I put into it every week is my volunteer labor, and you know, I've been doing the show for 7 years.
Wow,
and. I can't even count how many times I've almost hung up the headphones,
right.
Metaphorically speaking.
It's hard. It's hard. I mean, for me, I mean, this is beyond any, it's not ideological, finally. I mean, it's also, for me, it's a 2.5 hour commute to get to the radio station because it's just New York traffic and all that. And if I do trains, it's even worse. So, you know, I get in my Mini and I drive and all the way to the city and then through the Holland. It's a station in New Jersey and I'm on the Hudson River on the New York side. So, you know, when you add 5 hours commuting and you've got a 4-year-old kid, it's like, it's a whole big thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the real answer to it is to do, you know, what's that, you know, live blog radio or to do something like that with my nice little, you know, blue snowball, you know, microphone and put up podcasts and, you know, and do it in a way that's appropriate to my scale. You know, the reason I like doing real radio is I am still a fan of radio, of broadcast, of the airwaves, of people in their cars and in their offices having this box with a speaker and a crystal, or I guess they don't have crystals and radios anymore, but there's something in there that actually receives this signal. There's something that feels, I know this is pretty damn nerdy, but there's something that feels kind of almost organic about analog radio.
I'm with you.
Yeah. So, although it's probably all digital too, but there was something terrestrial, you know, we call it terrestrial signal that I wanted to be a part of that.
And unfortunately, there's very few stations like WFMU anywhere, never mind in the greater New York area. I don't know, there might be low-power FM stations closer to your home environs, or maybe there's some other technological way to keep the show going. But I'd like to encourage you to keep it going. I'm a podcast listener to your program.
Great. I mean, the easy way to keep it going is to just... and this is what I'm trying to do, is to have the Media Squad collective take over more of the show so that
not always as easy as it sounds though.
No, it's not, you know, it's because it's hard. People don't want to make radio. I mean, it's hard to make stuff. It's hard to do stuff, but, you know, I'm looking at alternatives where rather than going in every week to do the show, I mean, there's people living in New Jersey who are close, who are willing to man the board. And if I do like you do sometimes, you know, if I do a good interview from on my Skype and put it on, you know, in an MP3 file and upload it somewhere and let someone else host the show and play the thing, I can still kind of deliver the content without actually being there. The only downside to that is I don't get off on it. You know, there's just something about being in a radio studio with that big mic in front of you and knowing that there's live humans. And I don't think it's just imaginary. I think we are living in the same moment and doing something live that's touching other people, that's filling their car, their bodies with sound in the moment is a I hate to use a word like this, but it's kind of a spiritually connected act that, you know, making a file that is playing in an asynchronous fashion for someone over the internet is not. Not to say that both don't have their place, but there's something unique about the live radio moment that fills me, and I think listeners, with something that they don't get through any other medium. And I want to demonstrate my faith in this medium.
I agree with you. I did this program for 6 months almost last year as a podcast, because I did not yet have an outlet in Chicago. And that was the worst 6 months of the show for me. And when I had to, put it together, record, I get very perfectionistic in the moment, and I re-record my voice tracks 100 times over to get them right.
I know. You do the show live, it's only going to take as long as the hour.
But when I'm doing it in not real time, it would take me longer. Right. It was more drudgery, and I did not enjoy it, frankly. Yeah. And I give me that hour in the studio when, I get it right or I get it wrong. And to be honest, since I have 13 stations which take it as a pre-recorded program, I edit a little bit, to take out a couple of the worst gaffes at times, or when we have, it's a college station, sometimes when we have equipment problems, I'll edit that out. But by and large, I let it fly about as live as it can be, and it is a different experience. And I've been trying to take Twitter responses and take people's emails, and we take IMs, and we take calls on the air when we can. And it's nice when we get that kind of feedback, although it's very up and down, even in a city as big as Chicago. Maybe there's a way you could figure out how to Skype your show in, so you can be live up there in the Hudson Valley, and be but yet still be there on FMU. But your show stands out to me. I mean, it resonated with me immediately when I saw it come up. I was already familiar with your work, but that grassroots approach on my own show. I do cover policy because policy matters. It does change things. It does have effects. But I get frustrated too, because I want to talk to people who are out there, as you say, real people doing real things, because that's in the media and wherever else, because to me, that's why I do the show in the first place. I want there to be a place and a way for people to do that. Well, Doug, I think we've probably exhausted it.
Yeah, I think we've exhausted you at the very least. Yeah, exhausted our listeners talking about radio on the radio.
Oh, no. We've learned that I have a very significant population listening to my program who don't even own computers. And as soon as we talk about geeky radio stuff, the phones light up. So they're out there still, man.
God bless them.
They are still out there, and I'm glad to have them tuning in. But
long live radio.
Long live radio. Well, Doug, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Douglas Rushkoff, author of the new book, Life Incorporated, How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. Talking about everyday grassroots action, real people doing real things, also discussing his radio show, which is called The Media Squat. It airs on WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey, online at WFMU.org. You can learn more about Doug and all of his projects, including the radio show, at his website, which is rushkoff.com. And quickly, put out the Twitter question for tonight. Just a real simple question. Do you still actually listen to radio, and why? And I got a couple of responses. First, from Munter, which is twitter.com/MUNTER, says, yes, I only listen to college radio on the ride to work. He says it's too short to warrant the iPod. And Shuras, S-C-H-U-R-A-S, says, I still listen to radio because it's unpredictable when it's done right. Well, and if you're listening to Media Geek on the radio, I can guarantee you're on a station where radio is done right. And that brings to a close this edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in one more week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, go to the Media Geek website, home to the Media Geek blog, MediaGeek.net. The radio show is at radio.MediaGeek.net. The Twitter feed, twitter.com/MediaGeek. Lots of missives about what's going on in our media environment and other observations. Also, take your comments back. It's the feedback loop and the mechanism we want to hear from you. You can tweet back, twitter.com/MediaGeek, or send me email, paul@MediaGeek.net. And the radio show is produced live at WNUR-FM on the campus of Northwestern University in Evanston on the edge of Chicago, Illinois, at 89.3. It's also heard on fantastic stations like WTND in Macomb, Illinois, and KWMD in Kasilof, Anchorage, Alaska. And if you want to hear Media Geek on your local non-commercial station, go to the radio show site and download it, and then drop me a line to let me know you're playing it, paul@mediageek.net. Thanks a lot for tuning in.